From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Olympics keep churning along. Let's talk about other countries for once. Five British Olympians won gold on Sunday, including tennis player Andy Murray. And, of course, Jamaica is celebrating the fastest man in the world, still, Usain Bolt. So we're going to go to Rio in a few minutes.
But right now to the presidential campaign here in the U.S., the big story today is a connection between a pro-Russia political party in Ukraine and Paul Manafort, Donald Trump's campaign manager. Joining us now is NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Good afternoon, Jeremy.
And let's get to this story and have you break it down for us a little bit, because it does get complicated. This was first reported by the New York Times yesterday about Paul Manafort in Ukraine. He consulted for the former president there. We knew that. And in this case, we learned that handwritten ledgers there show millions of dollars in undisclosed cash payments designated for him. There is no proof that he received any of that money. But tell us, what should we make of this story?
Well, we know that Manafort consulted for Ukraine's ruling political party and the ousted former president Viktor Yanukovych, who was close to Vladimir Putin in Russia. There were about $12.7 million to Manafort that were earmarked between 2007 and 2012 that was unearthed by the new National Anti-Corruption Bureau in Ukraine, which is trying to figure out where some of the money went from the Yanukovych administration. And they said this was part of an off-the-book system, which included payments to election officials. Manafort now says that he never received cash payments, but you know, that money that he had taken from his time consulting for Yanukovych went to his firm. You know, Corey Lewandowski, who was the former campaign manager, actually retweeted this and then later said that he was only doing that to show how the media is really at fault here for going after Manafort. Now, there was also this $18 million deal that Manafort set up to help sell Ukrainian cable television to a partnership with a Russian an oligarch who is also a Putin ally. So a lot of this certainly raises more questions about Manafort's relationship, not just with Russia, but with a lot of the work that he's done for unsavory characters throughout the world during his lobbying days, from the Philippines' Ferdinand Marcos in the 1980s to Lebanon, to the Philippines, to Angola during that civil war, to Kenya, then Zaire's Democratic Republic. So, you know, this is a long, ongoing issue for Manafort and what it could mean for the Trump campaign. It's not clear at this point, but Trump is close to Manafort, and there's no sign that he's going to be leaving the campaign for any of this.
And it also plays in, of course, to the idea that the Trump campaign is particularly close with Russia after he had praised – Donald Trump had praised Vladimir Putin and then asked him to help find emails from the DNC. So I guess this will play out and we'll watch what happens there. But as we're talking about this, Domenico, we're not talking about Hillary Clinton and the emails. You know, what's going on there?
Yeah. And, you know, Donald Trump's delivering his big speech on ISIS today, which this story distracts from that. But on Hillary Clinton's email, certainly last week, you know, there were these emails that came out that showed that there was an aide to Hillary Clinton who was in talks with someone from the Clinton Foundation or Clinton Global Initiative to set up a meeting for a big donor for the Clinton Foundation. Now, the person who was supposed to be having this meeting with that person said that the meeting actually never took place. But it would play into normally how the Clintons are part of an old political system where rich and wealthy friends are trying to gain access and influence. And Donald Trump, just with a lot of this, overshadows any of the potential political points he could score going after Clinton for something like this.
As we are talking about all of these things, you're watching the polls come out, and it really is showing Clinton with leads in some very important places and some key swing states, as well as overall in the national picture. And we've got Donald Trump over the weekend going to Connecticut for a rally. We surprised a lot of people because they haven't voted Republican for a presidential election in Connecticut since 1988. Barack Obama won it by 18 percentage points in 2012. What do you make of where Trump is going and where Clinton is going to campaign, as here we are just, you know, less than 90 days until the election?
You know, I've had Republican sources tell me that Donald Trump actually thinks he can win Connecticut, even though Barack Obama won it by an average of 20 points in the last two elections, 18 and 2012. You know, this was an attempt by Trump to get some attention, but he really should focus elsewhere in places where he could persuade voters, because right now, poll after poll has showed him struggling against Hillary Clinton, especially in the states.
What do you think is going to be the closest state this election season? What's going to be the one that they're both going to be spending the most time in?
Well, look, Pennsylvania is a state that is really important to Donald Trump. If he doesn't win there, it's almost impossible to see a path for him. Ohio right next door, also someplace he needs to do well in. And of course, you watch Florida because it's always close.
Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead political editor. Domenico, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, there is an unsettling headline out of Rio. Four U.S. swimmers, including Ryan Lochte, were robbed at gunpoint early Sunday morning as they returned to the Olympic Village from a late-night party by people posing as police officers. Lochte had a cocked gun held to his forehead. No one was harmed, but the question of the safety of Olympians has somewhat taken the spotlight off yesterday's stunning performances. U.S. gymnast Simone Biles won gold in the vault, and a lightning bolt hit track and field.
Ken Bolt catching. Here he is, still invincible, Usain Bolt!
Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt on NBC last night, and he did catch Justin Gatlin to win his third straight 100-meter title. A win later this week in the 200 will mark an unprecedented accomplishment. Wins in both in three consecutive Olympics. The BBC's Alex Capstick joins us from Rio. And Alex, take security first. Besides the robbery, there was that earlier incident with a media bus which had its window shattered by what might have been bullets. Is there any talk about athletes being maybe escorted when they go outside the village?
No, I think athletes will want to be as independent as they possibly can. They don't want to have armed guards shadowing them everywhere they go when they're in their downtime, certainly. There was a suggestion that media buses should have an armed escort in between venues, but again, that's not really happened. There are lots of police around. There are helicopters flying above. But I guess if you talk to the athletes, they're just concentrating on what they do. And certainly in the downtime, I think they want to go out and have a bit of fun. And they don't want to be followed by armed escorts.
Well, let's talk about what they are doing. Can anyone beat Usain Bolt in the 200 meters?
You'd have to say at the moment, no. Although 9.81 seconds is the slowest time he's had at an Olympic final. But you have to say, going into the 200, that's his favourite event. And he hinted in his press conference that he was saving a little bit for that 200 metres. So we'll have to see, but certainly he would go into that race as a firm favourite to repeat the successes of London in 2012 and Beijing in 2008.
We'll talk about one other race last night, a world record set in the men's 400 metres by South African Wade Van Niekerk. What a story. His mom, also a runner, couldn't compete years ago because of apartheid. His 74-year-old white South African coach was in the stands. Just describe how he blew away the competition.
Yeah, a remarkable performance from Wade Van Niekerk. I was in Seville in 1999 when Michael Johnson set that record. And when he did that, everyone thought, well, that record will stand for a long, long time, perhaps forever. But Wade Van Niekerk just blew away the opposition. And when the clock stopped at 43.03, there was a gasp because we knew the world record had been beaten. Michael Johnson was sitting not too far away from us, and lots of people were turning around to look at what his reaction was. And he, clearly from what he's been saying, thought it was amazing, couldn't quite believe what had happened. But it's a great story. Wade Van Niekerk writing himself into the history books.
We also want to make sure we mention the British distance runner Mo Farah, also going for some Olympic history this week after he won the 10,000-meter race. Just remind us.
Yeah, I think, you know, some of the athletes, some of the great athletes, because they're operating in the Bolt era, you don't hear as much about them. They don't sort of get the headlines. Certainly Mo Farah gets the headlines in the United Kingdom, perhaps not elsewhere. But another remarkable athlete, he is going for the double-double. He won the 5,000 metres and the 10,000 metres Olympics in London 2012 in front of his home crowd. Fantastic atmosphere in London. And he won the 10,000 metres here the other day in typical Mo Farah fashion. He just follows the leaders until the final lap, and then he makes his bid for glory along with a few others, and as ever he blows them away in the final 100 metres. So he goes again in the 5,000 metres at the end of the week. All of his rivals are Africans, they're Kenyans and they're Ethiopians, but they can't beat him. They've been scratching their heads trying to find a way to get past him. They haven't been able to do it, and he will start the 5,000 as the favourite.
Yeah. And just one Russian athlete competing in track and field. We know the rest of the Russian team suspended because of doping. But even that lone athlete had her eligibility revoked after she got to Rio. Just how is the absence of the Russians affecting the races?
You talk about Daria Kleshina in the long jump. She's actually appealed that to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, and they've overturned that ban by the IAAF, so she can now compete. It will have an effect on the overall competition when you think of such global superstars like Yelena Isinbayeva, twice an Olympic champion, Sergei Shcherbakov, who is the sprint hurdle champion from Beijing last year, the world title holder. So it's a big team that's missing, some big athletes missing, but you don't hear too many other athletes from other countries complaining about it.
Yeah. The BBC's sports correspondent Alex Capstick at the Olympics in Rio as track and field just really takes over. Alex, thank you so much.
Okay.
As Donald Trump speaks about terrorism today, we want to focus on two words you'll probably hear. Sharia law. It's become so scary to many Americans that lawmakers in some states have tried to pass laws banning Sharia law. Joining me now is Khalid Abu El Fadl, who's a professor of law at UCLA and author of Reasoning with God, Reclaiming Sharia in the Modern Age. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I want to just start with the basic question. What is Sharia law?
At the very basic level, Sharia means the law of goodness. So it's very much akin to the basic concept of moral law or natural law. What is usually translated is Islamic law, which is the human extrapolations upon their understanding of the natural law of God or the moral law of God. Actually, when we talk about law of polygamy or we talk about law of jihad, we're really not talking about Sharia law. We're talking about Sharia law as extrapolated by subjective interpretations of human beings.
And what are some of the tenets of that are true, and what are some of the misunderstandings?
Well, a very good example. One of the basic laws, one of the fundamental principles of Sharia law, the moral law, the natural law of Islam, is a prohibition against killing. Now, the way the human beings have interpreted that is that they have created many caveats, many exceptions. Some exceptions make sense, like the exception of self-defense, that you may kill someone if they're trying to kill you, and that's the only way you can preserve your life. But other exceptions have done horrendous things in life, like you may kill people if you think they're oppressing you, and you think that the only way you can get rid of this oppression is to strike whoever you want to strike, wherever you want to strike. The other thing that is very important to emphasize is that there is no code of law known as Sharia law. Sharia law is very much like rabbinic law in the sense that it is this massive corpus of interpretations and counter-interpretations and counter-counter-interpretations. In other words, it's like an encyclopedic sea of opinions. And there is no church in Islam, so there's no definitive one source, institutional source, that can say, well, this is the law.
There's not a Supreme Court of Sharia,
yeah,
is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why you see so many different Muslims that follow different laws than they believe that they sincerely believe that that's the truth and that's what's legitimate. Some of the interpretations are so extremely out there, so out of the orthodox mainstream, that it's fair to say that the vast majority of Muslims see them as corruptions of their religion. And I think that we can definitely say this about most of the stuff that ISIS does or Qaeda does. Unfortunately, you're talking about a system that's 1,400 years old, very much like rabbinic law, where there's thousands of sources and thousands of sages, each one with their own school of thought, with a lot of people that try to speak to outsiders as if it's a code of law and, you know, trick people into thinking that they're the voice of God within the Islamic tradition.
But where can you see Sharia law reflected in legal systems in the Muslim world?
Most Muslim countries don't apply Sharia law except in a very limited area, some personal laws and so on. The countries that claim to apply Sharia law are Saudi Arabia, Iran, Pakistan, depending on the subject matter. And the most ironic thing is that these two countries are also the two countries where you most contested on the Sharia front. And in other words, I mean, if you ask me, I don't believe any of the interpretations of Saudi Arabia as to Islamic law are reasonable interpretations of the Quran, the tradition of the Prophet, tradition of the companions, the inherited opinion of the master sages. And I think you'll find a great deal of Muslims that feel the same way about Saudi Arabia. Same thing with Iran, and that's why a lot of Muslim dissidents that don't approve of the Iranian government. Part of what makes this picture complicated is that because of the lack of an authoritative, centralized, institutional, sort of a hierarchical system, there have been a great deal of self-interpretation by various dissident groups unhappy with which are mostly secular governments in power in the Muslim world, which were left over after colonialism. And a lot of these groups, like ISIS, like Muslim Brotherhood, although, of course, Muslim Brotherhood is ideologically quite different, unhappy with what they perceived as either secular governments or governments that kowtow to the interests of the West and sort of went off and invented their, truly invented interpretive tradition. Unfortunately, in the case of many of these groups, they interpret from the raw medieval text some opinions of some of the earliest sages. And what comes out is without proper learning and proper training and understanding, you end up with very funny and bizarre results.
And in some cases, some things that people in this country have been very critical of, cruel of course, punishments, yeah. Stoning women accused of adultery or amputating the hands of people caught stealing. How common is that kind of capital punishment in legal systems with Sharia law? Or is it just, as you're saying, these outside groups, the Taliban, the Muslim Brotherhood, that do these kinds of things?
All of that is part of the medieval Islamic legal corpus. So stoning for adultery, amputating hands of a thief, at the time they were extrapolated and articulated, they were unremarkable. All Near Eastern legal systems cut off limbs, and in fact, these were just regular criminal punishments. Now, these punishments have not been applied by Muslim countries for centuries, very much like Jewish law and Mosaic law and rabbinic interpretations. In that case, the sort of rabbis interpreted these laws in ways that made them unnecessary to apply. The same thing happened in Islam. So we don't have the last recorded case of cutting someone's hand or stoning someone before Saudi Arabia came along, but hundreds and hundreds of years ago.
But you're saying now it is happening in Saudi Arabia?
No. Then suddenly we have this puritanical birth of a country like Saudi Arabia, which claimed it's going to go back to the medieval laws and apply them. I should say that Iran tried this thing about stoning and cutting hands of thieves and then discovered very quickly that it doesn't work in the modern world, and so they suspended all stonings and all severings of hands of thieves and replaced them with more modern criminal laws.
So what do you think then when there are places in this country and people in this country, like in Oklahoma in 2010, they enacted a law banning the courts from considering Sharia law in their decisions. What do you think of people in this country who are concerned that Sharia law could be applied here and could take precedence over the U.S. Constitution and that there need to be laws to stop that from happening?
To me, that's ridiculous at so many fronts. We would need to figure out what type of Sharia law are they talking about. Are they talking about Sharia law, Saudi version? Because if that's the case, I would be the first to die resisting it. I mean, who will allow Sharia law to take precedence over the U.S. Constitution? I mean, on the legal side, as a law professor, this absolutely makes no sense, because American courts will not apply a law just because the litigants want. My response, though, I understand the fear of dealing with people who want to return back time and go to a time that is more cruel and less humane and reverse the achievements of human beings on the front of humanitarian thinking. And that is something neither I nor the vast majority of Muslims in the world can tolerate.
That's Khalid Abu El Fadl, who is a professor of law at UCLA. His book is called Reasoning with God, Reclaiming Sharia in the Modern Age. Professor, thank you for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
Every year around this time, when people are taking vacation, we hear stories about how little time off Americans actually take. But did you know that not taking vacation time could actually hurt your chance of getting a raise? A study from the U.S. Travel Association and Project Time Off found that people who took fewer than 10 of their vacation days a year had a 35% chance of getting a raise, but people who did take that vacation had a much higher chance, a 65% chance of getting a raise. Kurt Nikisch joins us now. He's senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Jeremy.
And tell us more about that statistic. Why does taking vacation make you more likely to get a raise?
Yeah, well, it's a really good question, and there's a lot to unwrap there. Number one is managers see happy employees as productive employees. So if you go away on vacation, you come back energized, you come back with more focus, you feel more productive. Manager sees that the same way, and you're going to be more likely to get a raise or a bonus. And a lot of people who do it the other way around think that, oh, I'm going to not take all my vacation, I'm going to put in extra time. And you can actually be seen as less productive that way. And in essence, you're essentially taking a pay cut when you do that. And so why give you a bonus if you're already working extra for free?
Well, I think the other thing about taking a vacation that can help you on the job is it allows you to see things in a slightly different way. You're out of your daily routine. You look at things, maybe you see the big picture a little bit better.
Absolutely. There's a growing body of research that shows that your brain needs a break. You know, for millennia, we have been seasonal creatures, and work is this construct where we have a very normalized work week, so many hours a week. It's very regular throughout the year, but your brain needs a break. And once you have that moment to kind of step back, you can step back into your work with more focus and more direction.
So why aren't people taking all of their vacation time?
Yeah, well, there's this saying that nobody exploits you better than you do yourself. So instead of sticking it to the man, everybody is actually kind of working extra. I think if you look at over the past 20 years, Americans actually take 1 week less vacation than they did 20 years ago.
Wow.
So it's gone from 21 days down to 16. And I don't think it's a coincidence that that has happened as technology has changed, as we've moved more towards a knowledge economy. And so at the same time that people feel like they're working more than ever because of technology, we're actually making the mistake of also working more than we have to.
And are employers on board with this idea that you become a better employee by taking more of your vacation time, or are they still pressuring workers not to take the vacation?
This is really interesting. I think employers are getting much smarter about this because there are some tech firms that offer unlimited vacation. They've actually found that people, when offered unlimited, they take less.
Yeah.
And so companies like Evernote are now paying $1,000 for employees to use towards travel on their vacation. And so they realize that they have to set a norm for people to take this. And, you know, we're also team creatures. So if nobody else takes all their vacation, you feel guilty letting down your coworkers. And managers have to get smarter about how to set this up so that people really do take advantage of everything they're owed.
Well, we'd love to hear from you about the vacation that you are taking. Are you taking all your vacation? Do you think it makes you a better worker? And if you are an employer, are you convincing your employees to take all of their vacation? Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review, thank you.
My pleasure.
In 2012, we spoke with Public Radio's Kurt Anderson about his novel, True Believers, whose main character, a female judge, has diabetes, as Kurt does. Listeners, especially diabetics, including my guy, Lore, were thrilled to see Kurt expose some of the myths about diabetes and some of the real challenges. One wrote of calling 911 in 1984 to help a friend, a type 1 diabetic, whose pancreas simply doesn't produce life-saving insulin to manage blood sugars, so she injected insulin but had injected too much and was slipping away. Our listener begged the EMTs for something, orange juice, to bring her back, but the EMTs were convinced diabetics couldn't have sugar. In more recent years, our house had to call 911, and while I tried to get some orange juice down my guy's throat, the dispatcher told me not to. Nothing to drink till the ambulance comes, she said, but that would be too late. We decided to reprise our talk with Kurt Anderson, starting with his first thought about being a type 1 diabetic.
It wasn't our fault. It's not a result of lifestyle choices or anything else. It's simply some still mysterious combination of genetics and environment that cause your pancreas to go kerflooey at some point.
There's nothing you could do. The pancreas is shot.
It's gone. So you, as a result, if you manage it well, you test your blood many, many times a day and inject insulin accordingly to try to do what your pancreas isn't.
And by the way, we always hear from people when we use words like fault to distinguish type 1 from type 2, people who have type 2 who say, well, wait a second, it's not, you know, fault is a bad word because sometimes they have a complicated medical condition called insulin resistance. You know this, right? But just to have said
I know all that and I understand that. And I was being somewhat tongue-in-cheek.
Right.
And there are tens of millions of people with type 2 diabetes, which is the more familiar one that is skyrocketing in incidence. And there are only 1 million or 2 million people in the United States with type 1.
And sometimes the people with type 2 can, through lifestyle changes, reverse theirs. Those are some of the distinctions. And so you have your character. Go to the first thing that jumped out. This idea that people with diabetes might have mood swings because of the high and low blood sugar. I mean, people know that themselves. If they don't have diabetes, you can get just sort of different moods if you eat a lot of sugar or if you haven't eaten enough. And yet for the diabetic, they're not sure if the mood is because they really feel the mood or if it's because of the diabetes. And further, they're insulted if someone else assumes it's because of the diabetes.
Those are all possibilities. Yeah, it's mostly low blood sugar that causes significant and problematic moods. Often when people are trying to control it too tightly, inevitably sometimes you overdo and you become hypoglycemic. And yes, it is biochemically the same thing that some people feel when they've missed a meal or two and get cranky. A friend of mine the other day was talking to me about this. He was unaware of the nature of my constant blood checking and all that and said, wow, I'm kind of jealous. I said, really, what? He said, I would love to be able to take a drop of my blood anytime I'm feeling angry or beleaguered and thereby have the objective answer of whether it's actual emotion or just some fluke of my blood chemistry. And of course, people say, oh, diabetes, it's treatable. It's this chronic disease and it's treatable. And that's all true and that's fine. But it is also, in this sort of hour-to-hour, day-to-day way, a thing that requires, you know, management and, as I depict in this fiction, has these subjective effects that, you know, are invisible to the world.
But also, it's one thing to be aware yourself, oh, you know, I might be getting cranky because I'm low. But then, if people around you know you're a diabetic, they might try to rob you of real feelings And has that happened to you where someone says, oh, you come on, you're just getting a little low or something, when you really feel something?
Of course. And there's nothing more annoying than that, or than the people, well-intended people around you who say, oh, are you low? So I've never thought of it as robbing me of real feelings.
Well, your character does. She's like, wait a second.
Yeah, she does. Yeah. And, you know, this sense of being infantilized, you know, and treated as a kid who isn't aware of his or her own emotions or state of wellness.
Right. Because of that fear that someone's just going to assign my feelings to my diabetes, a lot of people don't tell people. Your character does. I mean, makes a point of that. Do you? I mean, you are now.
Well, I am now. No, I've never denied it. And like my character, I'm pretty brazen in pulling out the works and shooting up in the middle of restaurants and so forth. So, you know, and I didn't do this in order to, like, achieve sympathy or anything else. I just thought it was an interesting thing for a character in fiction to be, because only in fiction can you really get inside somebody's head and suggest how this feels, how this is, how it is part of, you know, somebody's life.
At one point, the character does relay something, again, very familiar to people with type 1 diabetes, an experience where she had to call 911.
Yeah, well, in that case, actually, as I tell it in the story, her teenage daughter has to call 911 because she's gone into sort of a coma.
Her arms flailing. Luckily, her daughter hears a noise and goes into the room and discovers her and calls 911. So, Kurt Anderson, do you have 911 stories?
I've had, you know, a couple, three serious experiences. Not for many years, knock wood. As I say, I've been doing this for more than 20 years, and in the first few years, yeah, it was figuring out what was what and exactly the combination of food and medicine and exercise and all the rest.
Sure.
That one needed to do to keep on the straight and narrow.
Well, I'm going to share one. My guy, who has diabetes, type 1, same as you, and something I've learned is that, I mean, I pray I don't ever get it, because I just think you have to be so on top of things, including knowing that there's a long-term insulin that you might take at night, and right, then there's shorter term. And at least in his case, the bottles looked exactly the same except for a tiny dot. And so one night he mixed them up. And the next thing I know, the phone rings at about 2:30 in the morning. I'm like, answer your phone. Will you answer your phone? And he can't answer the phone because he's practically in a coma, as you said. And, you know, we call the emergency services, and thank goodness they're able to bring him back with some orange juice. People think you need insulin when you go into this situation. You don't. You need sugar.
It's the opposite. You need sugar of some
right.
sort. Yeah.
And you want to know something? You know, hours later, we're thinking, wait a minute, who was on the phone? It was a butt call.
Wow.
And you know what else? It happened a second time with a butt call at like 2:30 in the morning. And the phone rang, alerted us to the fact that he was slipping into a coma. So, you know,
that's bizarre.
It is, but it just underscores people who think, oh, you just manage it. No, I was told by the EMTs, all happens all the time. A huge amount of their calls come from diabetics. You know, some just have gotten their science off.
Well, exactly. And it is this, as you say, this complicated playing doctor thing of these different vials, multiplication of to figure out the sort of algorithm that you're, okay, this is 3 hours ago, I ate 2 hours from now. You know, yeah, it's complicated. And I'm lucky I'm good at math. My wife often says to me, I wouldn't be able to do this. It's a constant thing. But again, as chronic conditions go, I mean, I'd choose this over many, many, many others I could name.
There you go. But this idea of being more public about it, I've looked in all these online chat places, and all these people are talking and saying things recently, saying things like, Jesus, has anybody ever felt cranky, or does anyone know about mood swings? Do you think people are told about this, you know, in the
it's
diabetic
a very good
community?
Question. Yeah. I don't know. And I don't spend a lot of time on websites or reading books about this. But yeah, I know when I was diagnosed, my endocrinologist, to be frank, did a terrible job of letting me know what this might mean and how to really manage this. And, you know, that was some years ago, but I'm sure there are still doctors who do a terrible job of letting people know how to deal with it.
On the other hand, the people that I know with type 1 diabetes, and I can now add you to that list, are some of the most achieving, successful people I know. And so I don't know if it's just keeping ahead of that thing chasing you. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I did well in school and was having a perfectly good career before I was diagnosed. But for me, it marked a certain kind of end of youth where I could just galump through life thinking, oh, everything will be okay. it really required me to focus on all of the things, you know, exercise, diet, blah, blah, blah. And you can live a full and happy and fulfilling life. But it is this thing that kind of connects you to your mortality when you're 33 years old in a way that is sobering and chastening.
That's Kurt Anderson, host of WNYC Studio 360 and author of the 2012 book True Believers, with a diabetic in a starring role. And after that talk, we heard so many listeners say people think they're drunk or on drugs when they're having low blood sugar episodes and need sugar. And since then, they've also told us of apps, technology attached to the body that can send a warning smartphone call, say to a parent of a diabetic away at college, when sugar plunges. We'd love to hear from you now. Share your stories of living with diabetes. When our colleague Karen Miller Medson isn't producing stories for us or baking her incredible cakes, yes, we won the Public Radio Cake Week competition sponsored by Vermont Public Radio. We'll have a picture of Karen's incredible likeness of me and Jeremy atop her entry at hereandnow.org. But when she's not doing that, Karen is running, and she had the run of her life this past week, joining a group of men and women running through the Andes Mountains to Machu Picchu, the ancient Inca citadel in Peru. The trip supports an organization called Strive, which takes student athletes to small communities in Peru and Kenya, where they work on building and education projects. And as athletes, they also get to train at altitude, which, if you've seen the runners from Kenya, you know can be an advantage when they are competing back at sea level. So we are all living through Karen this past week. You can, too. Pictures of her trip are at hereandnow.org. We caught up with her at a point where she got cell phone coverage a few days ago and asked, you know, what's up?
So I'm on a trip called Running to Machu Picchu. So we start off in Cusco at 11,500 feet. We acclimate for a few days, and then we literally run to Machu Picchu.
Why?
Because we can. Something to, you know, what I did this summer kind of thing.
Right.
It's a group of runners, and it's led by Tyler Andrews, who's got this program, Strive. They do community work in Peru. And he decided to take a group of adults this summer. So I signed on.
Well, it's giving you a chance to really see. I mean, we'll explain to people Machu Picchu, glorious as it is. There are some people who just get to Lima, hop on a bus, and take the express, go to Machu Picchu, and leave. You can also trek over the course of a week, and then you really get to meet people. And it's like you're trekking kind of quickly and really seeing the people of Peru. What are you seeing?
It's unbelievable. So because we're running from village to village, we're not going to places where a lot of tourists go. So we're running through the Sacred Valley, and we're running on this dirt trail that goes through the whole Sacred Valley along the Sacred River. That's the whole Inca territory. You see just the massive Andes Mountains, the farmland sort of graded up the mountains. There's llamas, there's alpacas, there's pigs cross our paths. It's like red dirt path. And then when we get to these villages, it's markets and ancient ruins. And two nights we're staying with families. I don't speak a word of Spanish. It's interesting, and it's a big challenge.
Well, what do they think of you? Because having trekked through Peru, this is a while back, but this is a very simple lifestyle that's much the way it was. What do they think of, and they've seen tourists, certainly trekkers coming through, but what do they think of somebody running through?
Near the bigger towns like Pisac, they're kind of used to it because other runners occasionally run through. But when you get out of, sort of really out of where tourists would go or where cities are, people just kind of stop and stare. Honestly, I don't know what they're thinking, but they certainly are watching.
Yeah, yeah, in wonder.
It's a bit of a spectacle, I think.
Well, can you tell us more about Strive?
It's mostly based in Peru, but they also have an arm in Kenya. It's all educational-based, so any kid can go and get English lessons, tutoring, almost child care in a sense, because kids come and bring their 2 and 3-year-old siblings. And then the high school kids help build and paint the Strive Center. And it's associated with an elementary primary school. And it's not a sort of touchdown, you know, in the summer for kids to do a week of service. It's sort of a whole summer, and then it operates year-round.
So one of your boys participated in Strive, am I correct?
Yep, he did 3 summers. He did one in Peru as a high school student, one in Kenya as a high school student, and then one came back to Peru as a group leader. And I should also say that it's really for student athletes, so it's kids who want to train at high altitude.
Yeah.
So it's student athletes who are doing the summer work.
Well, so I mean, a lot of parents are lucky enough to be able to, you know, have their kids go to these summer volunteer programs. But how great that you get to actually go see what he did.
Oh, it was wonderful. You know, I've been seeing pictures of this for 3 years, and it was really special to go and see, you know, the center that they painted and the work that the kids have done there. And yeah, it was really a wonderful opportunity. And besides just wanting to try to run from Cusco to Machu Picchu, it was one of the reasons that I wanted to come down. I just wanted to really see what they were doing, and it was worthwhile.
Yeah. Well, Karen Miller-Medson, we wish you every good thing when you get to this magical, mystical, spiritual place, Machu Picchu. I hope one thing you do have, I was lucky enough to see, fireflies.
Fireflies. Okay, I'll look for fireflies. Sounds wonderful.
They were swarming the place. Karen, best of luck to you.
Okay, thank you, Robin.
Our colleague, producer Karen Miller-Medson, somewhere in the Andes Mountains a few days ago. Yesterday, she did make it to Machu Picchu. Alas, no fireflies, but incredible sights and a llama. We'll have pictures at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.